Here we go.
Well, when I went to USC, I graduated in 1916, so it was the fall of 1912, and I went to USC.
A rarity for girls to go to college, or
not? Oh, no, it wasn't a rarity.
Oh, no, your mother
didn't graduate. No, it wasn't a rarity at all. And we didn't have national sororities then at USC, we had locals. And so I was invited to belong to Entre Nous, and we used to play the ukulele, and we had all kinds of activities. We had plays and so forth, and I was mixed up in all of it. And I suddenly realized that we didn't have any glee club at USC when I was a freshman. I was a freshman, and there was no glee club, no men's or women's glee club. Mm. So I thought, oh, that's terrible. So I went to the president, and I said, can't we have a glee club? Now, I'll do the work in getting all the people together. And he said, we don't have any money. And I said, Bill Wheatley was in high school with me, and he's done some directing, and he's going here now. We went to L.A. High School, and I said, if he would be willing to do it for nothing, would you let us have a glee club? And he said, oh, sure. He said, you probably won't amount to anything, but he said, go ahead. I said, fine. So I got Bill Wheatley to say he would direct the glee club, and I gathered together all the people that I knew had voices and some that didn't have, and we started out, and we had a glee club. And we were so good that we were invited to go on a tour, and we went around to all the small towns and around Los Angeles and gave concerts. And we were so good that first year that the second year they gave us the professor of music, whose name was Cogswell, and he directed it from then on, and the glee club was started.
Do you know, could anybody just go and knock on the president's door?
Oh, sure.
And say,
oh, yes.
I have an idea?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
It was very open.
Very open when in those days. And, of course, it was a very small college. There were only about 5,000 in it when I first went there. Now it's about 23,000. So it was a small college in the beginning, and it wasn't very expensive, and wonderful professors and everything, but it was very different.
Do you remember what the tuition was?
I think it was $7 a... I think it was about $17 a semester, and I think it's something like 21 or 2 a unit now.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it was about $17 a semester for all of it.
Being a private school, did you have to wear anything? Did they have a dress code?
No dress code.
So you could, wear... Yeah. What did women wear back in 1912?
Well, the thing I remember so definitely was they wore midi suits, the old... what did they call those? They were collars like the Navy wore, with pleated skirts, and they were made out of blue serge with white braid around. There was a special name for them, and they were very expensive. Yes, they were very expensive, and I never could afford to have one. I think they cost maybe $35, which was a lot of money in those days, and I always wanted one. Mm. I had nice clothes, but I didn't have that, and I always felt real sad about that. Well, anyway, as I went on through, I was in all kinds of things, in plays, and I was assistant editor of the Elverdale, which was the book we got out every year, and I was president of the YWCA and all kinds of things. So I was very active, and I took, as I remember, botany. And out on the field was the basketball field, and that was where the basketball players were practicing, and also later the football players. And one of the persons that was very good at athletics was Charles English Milliken, whom they called Pat. And he was in law school, and he practiced down there, and I used to watch him didn't know him at all. I used to watch him and thought he was really quite good. So when I finally met him, I felt that I knew quite a bit about him because I'd watched him practice and so forth so long.
How long did it take you to meet him after you started watching?
Well, that's what I'm going to tell you. That's very interesting. In the old days, of course, they didn't do like they would now. They'd come up now and say, "Hi, I've seen you around campus. I'd like to meet you, and how are you, and where'd you come from," or whatever. In those days, they'd try to find somebody that knew you and introduce you. So this man, I found out afterwards, found somebody that knew me and told him, his name I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, he told him that he would like to meet me and that if he ever had an opportunity, why, to let him know and he'd be at the proper place where he could meet me. And so I finally did meet him. But before that, he had seen me at a banquet because we were in a play together. This man whom his name was Leo Daze, he was supposed to be my husband in the play. And we were having a banquet, and of course I was his date at the banquet, and this Pat that I'm talking about, whom I later met, was having dinner. It was the old City Club, and he was having dinner with a man friend of his who was also a student at law school, and he said to Woodson Wallace, the friend, "There's the girl I'm going to marry." I heard this afterwards, of course, and Woodson said, "Well, who is she?" And he told him his name, and he said, "Well, I've never heard you talk about it." And he said, "Well, I've never met her yet, but I'm going to, and she's the girl I'm going to marry."
And this was your husband.
So he arranged, and when he found out that this friend of his knew me, why, then he waited his time till I met him. And when I met him, of course, I didn't attach any significance to it because I didn't know anything about this. I was going down into the basement one day in the college to have lunch. We had a cafeteria down there. And I saw this boy down at the bottom of the stairs, and this friend of mine that I knew said, "Wait a minute, I want you to meet somebody." And so he introduced me to this Pat Milliken. Well, I didn't pay a bit of attention. I knew he was just a person. And then later, he just happened to come along when I was carrying my tray and asked me if I wouldn't like to have him carry my tray. And I said, "Well, that would be nice." And so I invited him to sit at my table, and we had lunch together. And from then on, 6 weeks from then on, he had proposed. And one of the things he did, he found out that I like watermelon, so he hired a little express wagon with a 40-pound watermelon in it, and it drove up to my house, my residence where I lived with my mother and family, and delivered this 40-pound watermelon. And all of these different things, he just thought of everything under the sun. I've never seen anything like it.
You were, what year in school were you when you met?
I was a senior.
You were a senior, and
I was a senior. He was in law school, yes.
So he was
and he was not only in law school, but he had graduated, and he was then coaching the baseball team, and he was in charge of the trial court in law school. So he had seen me a whole year before that, but by the time I met him, he was out of college, and he had gotten his master's in law, and he was in charge of the trial court. You see, after you are in school, you have to go through the practice in an assumed type of a court to get the experience, and he was in charge of that. Then later, he had the opportunity, he was the assistant dean of law, and he had the opportunity of being the dean of the law school at USC, but decided to go into private practice instead and did so.
And
so,
he was about 5 years older. And he courted
you. He was four and a half years old.
4 years old.
Yes,
four and a half years
old.
Yeah. And he courted you for 6 weeks, and then he proposed.
Yes. Yes. He just perfectly.
Did he go through your father, or did he just directly ask you?
No, I think he talked to my mother and father. Yes, he talked to my mother and father the way they did in those days. Yes, and his father was a minister, Methodist minister, and so he said, and I was at that time I was a Congregationalist, First Congregational Church in Los Angeles, and he said that he felt that people, when they were married, should belong to the same church, and he had talked to his father about it, and his father approved of the fact that he should join the Congregational Church because we shouldn't be in a different church. So, of course, we didn't do that. I joined the Methodist Church because I thought that was much more important when his father was a minister.
Religion was very important.
Very important.
In his life.
Yes.
And
always has been in ours.
In
yes.
In your life, too. It's very
always
important
has been,
yeah. Your life.
In the old days, in Eureka, I can remember talking about religion. In the old days in Eureka, which, as I said, was a lumber town, and people were very much individuals, they believed very strongly in whatever they believed in. You would, if a person was a Catholic, you wouldn't be friends with them. And if you were going down the street and you weren't a Catholic, you would walk on the other side of the street. You wouldn't walk by the Catholic
goodness.
Church. And you just didn't have friends in other churches, the hard-shelled Baptists and the other people in other denominations were just not friends of yours in those days.
Yeah,
so,
and you said that the church, when you were in high school, people didn't really socialize that much at LA High because everyone came from such a faraway place, but...
But your own church. All your social life was around the church.
Yes.
And of course, that was true of all churches.
That was true of all churches, yes.
That's really where your whole social life was centered.
What year were you and Pat Milliken married?
Now, Pat Milliken was only a nickname. His name was Charles English Milliken. And
Did you call him Pat?
Yes, I called him Pat.
The reason
his name was Pat is because he was so very famous as a baseball player. And he was like a Chicago, is it Cubs? Yes,
yeah.
I guess. Player and said he was so much like this very famous one whose name was Pat, and so they dubbed him Pat, and he liked it, and he was always called Pat all of his life,
always called Pat.
And so most people don't even know what his name is. And our oldest son, who is Charles English Milliken Jr., he was never called Charles either. When he was born, why, I felt that as long as we didn't call his father Charles English, that he ought to be, you know, have a name of his own. And so I said, and someone said, well, he thought it was too bad for him not to be a junior. And I said, well, I wouldn't know who he was being a junior because we didn't call the father anything but Pat. So we didn't decide what we were going to call him for quite some time. So one day he was about... 2 years old, no, 3 years old. He was sitting on the steps out in front of his house, and a neighbor went by, and he says, "What's your name, little boy?" And he looked up like this, and he said, "They don't know yet. We call him Charles English Milliken Jr. Bradner K. Pat." And we used to do that in fun, you see, just being fun till we decided. And it evidently, you know, he got a complex over the thing, and he said, "They haven't decided." So we decided that we should name him, and regardless of whether he had a nickname or not, we should name him Charles English Jr., and did. And he is Charles English Jr., but he has never called anything except Bradner.
Brad.
His name is Brad. That was one of the names that we liked. And so he got started being called Brad, and he's Brad. So in the telephone book, he puts Charles English Brad Milliken.
Charles English Brad Milliken.
They're crazy. So, you see, we've always been very independent and very close, but we all do very different types of things. We're individuals and like to be that way, yet we're very close. Now, let's see, where do you want me to go back to now?
Well, I still haven't gotten you and Mr. Milliken married yet.
Oh,
I got you.
What?
I got you engaged.
All right,
I
got you married. We got us engaged. All right. So, at that time, when we met, I was, the war came along, and he was going to go, pretty soon he was going to go to war. And so I took a job as the recreation director of the YWCA in downtown Los Angeles.
So you had a career then?
Yes, every night while he would come and pick me up, I had to work at night, you see. And I had charge of all of the, for instance, the girls that worked in stores. They would come at night and have recreation. I did lots of recreation and swimming and plays and all kinds of things. And he would meet me because he didn't want me to go home alone, naturally. And so he would meet me, and we would ride the streetcar home because he had no car. We'd ride the streetcar home, and then he would actually ride the streetcar back to where he lived.
What?
So there was
loyalty.
Did you get paid?
I got
paid $40 a month.
$40
a month? I graduated from college, and I had degrees, and I got $40 a month. I was going to teach first, and I put in my application different places, and I had the opportunity of teaching in a private school. One of them was Page Military Academy, which is still going out in Los Angeles. And I didn't take that because they wouldn't give me a private room. I would have gotten $30 a month, room and board, but I would have had to room with somebody, and I didn't want to do that. So I decided I would accept the YWCA recreation job, even though I had to work at night.
Did you have a private room in your family's home? Did you share a room
with
your
sister? Not in the beginning, no, but I didn't want to share with somebody I didn't know. No, I didn't have a private room.
So
no, I was in a room with my sister.
Did you, something I just thought of, did you live on campus or did you commute from your family?
No, I didn't, we lived close to the campus, so I didn't.
So you took the streetcar?
No, yeah. No, I didn't live at the sorority house. No,
okay.
I either walked or took a streetcar.
Walked or took a streetcar?
Uh-huh. So then, again, we haven't gotten married yet. So then he was called into the service and was a, what they called a ground flyer. And that is you get out the, aviation section of the Signal Corps is what he was in. Aviation section of the Signal Corps, which is called a ground flyer. And they got out the wood, the fir and the spruce for the planes and the ships. So he was sent up to, after he was trained, he was sent a lot of places, Texas and whatnot, and then he was going to be sent clear up to the North Woods to get out, be in charge of a detachment of soldiers, and was going to get out the lumber. So he wanted me to get married. Well, in the meantime, the YW that I worked for as a recreation director wanted me to go into war work. So they talked me into going up to Vallejo, which is across from Mare Island Naval Base, and start a USO, a hostess house.
So you were the hostess house.
I started it from scratch. And the only thing I was told, Vallejo is an old, old town, and this is what they told me. The only thing they told me to do, they said, you go up there, and if you can sell the Catholic priest on your reason for being there and wanting you, you'll stay. Otherwise, you'll have to come back. So I went up and interviewed the Catholic priest and told him what I was hoping to do, and he was very nice to me and said that he would be very happy to cooperate. So I remember my first meeting with, they asked me to talk to this private Catholic school. And I remember very well the first thing when I was talking to him, telling him what we were doing, I said, now one of the things that I want you to always remember about me is that I'm very optimistic. And I said, I always feel that things are going to work out. And I said, one of the things that I always say is, the inner side of every cloud is bright and shining. I therefore turn my clouds about and always wear them inside out.
Oh, what a cute thing.
So I said, now let's all say that together. And then I said, we'll all be in the same boat. So all together, all of the pupils in that auditorium said, the inner side of every cloud is bright and shining. So anyway, they let me stay, and I started the hostess house, and some of the neighbor boys painted the place. I got somebody to donate a building, and then they came over and painted it, and we gave a benefit, and we had a parade.
Girl?
Yeah, I was the only girl.
And all these men around?
Yeah, that's right. And
did they flirt?
Oh, sure. And then we had a parade and we had all these things. And then when I heard that, that Pat was going to be sent to up the North Woods, why, of course, he wanted me to get married. So I couldn't just walk out on the thing, so I had to get somebody to take my place. So I finally got a girl whom I knew down here and had to bring her up there and get her trained and so forth so I could leave. So then I left and went up and was married and lived in a little log cabin up on up in the North Woods and ate at a cookhouse. And then later the war.
What year was this?
This was 1918.
1918.
Then the war closed. I was up there about a year. And, of course, I loved it because that's what, well, you see, I was back in Oregon where I used to go blackberry picking and huckleberry and everything, and this was out in the woods. So I just loved it. I thought it was very exciting.
Was it very difficult adjusting to the luxuries of a metropolitan area like Los Angeles going back to a log cabin?
No, it was wonderful. I didn't have to cook. Of course, we ate at the cookhouse, and it was all different, and yet we'd go from one camp to another on inspection tours and riding this Jeep, and oh, they didn't call it a Jeep, it was something or other. And no, it was all very exciting. I didn't think it was difficult at all. I thought it was wonderful.
Sort of like an adventure.
And yes, and of course, they had this train that they go out and cut down the trees and lift them up, you know, and put them on trains and so forth and bring them in. And if there was an accident, they'd whistle, a certain whistle. So you always keyed. If you'd hear that whistle, you know somebody had had an accident, somebody was hurt. And I can remember, I can still hear that whistle. You wouldn't know whether it was your own family or your own husband or somebody else, and some bad things happened. And you'd hear that whistle, just like the fire engine, you know, in the early days when you'd hear the fire engine, everybody would get excited and run to the fire. Well, that's what this was.
Back to the USO experience and starting this USO for all these Navy men and being the only woman.
Well, I got a lot of Native girls in on it, too.
So,
sure, that helped me. Sure.
Okay.
I had a committee, and everybody was anxious to help. They were wonderful.
Were the men, how did the Navy men of World War I compare to our Navy men today as far as their, I don't want to say desire for women, but...
Well, I don't know. They were all wonderful.
They were all wonderful.
Oh, yes, they were marvelous. They just did everything you wanted them to. Couldn't do enough.
Did they expect anything in return
no.
for all of their
oh,
favors?
No.
They didn't
no.
expect
oh, no.
like the like
no.
some people?
Not at all.
Not at all. That's
not at all, I should say. My goodness. Yes, you didn't even, you know, people didn't hold hands at first to even... They didn't even try to hold hands when you'd go out with people for a long time. So it was so different.
What prepared you? This is where we sort of lack the knowledge because no one has taken the time to tell us. How did young women prepare for marriage?
They didn't too well.
For example,
when I was growing up, I can remember that they used to tell children, you know, that the stork brought the babies. And I can remember when I was in Independence, I was told that the stork would leave it under the bridge sometime. And I used to go day after day looking under the bridge to see if I'd see a baby or a stork bringing a baby. And it was, long, long, long time before I knew the difference, which I think is just ghastly. And about menstrual period and so forth, my mother didn't tell me. She finally left a book on the table about it, but the way I first learned about it was from a friend. And they called it the monthly.
Monthly?
Yeah, that was the name. And there were ads in the paper also you'd see about the monthly, and it would say that... something about, ask your doctor to explain the monthly or something. And so I asked one of my older girlfriends what the monthly was, and she explained it to me then. No, she didn't tell me. I don't know what she knew, but I wouldn't have asked her anyway.
You wouldn't have asked her?
Oh, no, I wouldn't have thought of asking her, no.
So
it really is pretty sad. Pretty sad. Really pretty sad. way people didn't know and weren't prepared.
Well, were you prepared at all for marriage?
Well, when at the stage when I was married, they were commencing to have contraceptives. It was the condom, you know, like the rubber thing over, and so forth. And nobody told you very much about it. In fact, most people were not. And I've had girls come and ask me after I was married to explain things to them because they couldn't get any information from anybody or their parents and so on and so forth. So it was pretty sad. And it was then that the doctors were commencing a little bit to give out information. But of course nowadays you have a conference with your doctor and usually together, prospective husband and wife go together, but that wasn't true in the old days.
Did you or your husband practice any form of birth control at
yes,
all?
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm.
So you had spaced your children?
Yes, that's right.
And mm-hmm. waited it out?
Yes, they were planned.
They were all planned?
Mm-hmm, they were planned. That was the beginning of the planning.
Beginning
just about that time was the beginning
about
of
the 1920s.
But yes, the first child was born in 22.
So you were married 4 years then, before mm-hmm. you.
We had one miscarriage, and then the first one was born in the, 4 years after we were married. And see, the first one was, miscarriage was about a year before that. So we didn't have children for about 2.5 years, and then there was a miscarriage, and then Shirley was born.
You said you had, what, four children?
Four children. Girl, boy, girl, boy.
Just like your own?
Just like your own. Uh-huh.
Just like your,
mm-hmm.
just like your brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
Did you continue to work after you were married? You worked after the USO
The only time I worked after I was married was not by plan. It was because they sort of drafted me. I started the USO in Los Angeles. On 7th Street, we had a USO up in the second floor of the Black Shops, mm-hmm. and I'd had experience with it, you see, up in Vallejo, and so, and being a YW secretary, why they dragged me in and got me interested in starting that one. So I did that until they got it started, and then I didn't, because I didn't want to work. And then the only other time I worked was a very interesting time, which I'd like to tell you about another time, because
okay.
this is a very interesting thing.
Yeah, we are sort of running
yes.
low on tape.
And I think this next is quite important, because you can see the effects of what we started a long time ago, which is the consumer field.
Oh,
and I was a consumer education leader, and in the field of consumer education, I was a representative of a national magazine, and I gave talks for the consumer and did all of that as a volunteer, and then they drafted me in to teach the teachers of consumer, which was a very interesting thing.
Was this all volunteer work?
Well, when they drafted me to teach, why, of course, I had to be paid for that. But when I got the teachers all trained, and they just turned me loose, they said, well, nobody knows any more thing more than you do, so you go ahead and do what you want to do. Why, then I quit teaching, and then I didn't work anymore.
What was your...
Because my husband was an attorney, and he
was
making good money,
yeah,
and I didn't need to work.
You didn't need to work. Would your husband have let you work?
Well, he knew that if he was going to live with me, that he had to let me do the thing that I was excited about, and he learned to do that. You know, I was that kind of a person. I wouldn't be happy unless I was busy, and so he, unless I went too far with it, why, he cooperated. He didn't encourage me because he didn't need to encourage me.
But he didn't.
But everything I did, I never did anything that wasn't in some way tied in with my family, because I felt very strongly about that. I felt that any of the activities, outside activities I did, had to be tied into my family in some way, either making me more worthwhile, like I was in the university in UW, or anything I did in PTA or anything like that had to do with the children. And so whatever I did was geared to the needs of my family. And this consumer education that I'm going to tell you about another time, which is very exciting, had to do with knowing how to be a better mother and businesswoman in the home. That was the whole thing. We were just commencing to be businesswomen not because we were working, but because we were handling the money, paying the bills and the beneficiaries of insurance and all that sort of thing. So, yes.
That's something that we'll have to get into.
It's very, very interesting.
Yes, that's something that will be.
And I have saved all of the material and all of the articles I've written for many, many national magazines and so forth in the field of consumer education. And now you see it every place. I could have gone back in with it, but I wasn't interested.
Well, we're about at the end of this tape.
Yes.
I think we're at a good stopping spot.
I think so.